Our guest speaker this morning, Michael Esselin, is a Unitarian Universalist and the chaplain for St. Vianney's UCLA Center for Integrative Oncology. He works primarily with acute oncology, but also adult psychiatric patients at the Resident Neuropsychiatric Hospital at UCLA. He's been invited many times to speak to undergraduate students at UCLA about his work as a chaplain, on death and dying, and the spiritual dimension of the cancer experience. He's also led workshops on integrating spirituality into lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender identity. Michael is also co-founder and co-chair of a nonprofit volunteer anti-homophobia speakers bureau called GLIDE, Gays and Lesbians Initiating Dialogue for Equality. Over the last 15 years, Michael and his fellow speakers have spoken to an audience of over 100,000 students, teachers, and other various groups and agencies in the LA area about homophobia. He shares his life with Scott, his partner of 31 years. He is a member of the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Santa Monica and has been a popular guest speaker there and at over a dozen UU congregations in Southern California. Please welcome Michael Esselin.
Good morning. And it's a wonderful joy to be back here. Thanks for having me back. In November of 2008, my dear friend and GLIDE colleague, Rebecca Weinreich, she invited me on behalf of her 11-year-old daughter, Shoshana, to be Shoshi's escort for the special holiday cotillion at the Wilshire Ebell in Los Angeles in Hancock Park, not having an adult handy of the opposite gender. And I like to think my background as a professional dancer kind of bumped me to the top of the list. How did I feel? I was over the moon on so many levels. Of course, I was so honored to have been asked, but I attended cotillion myself in Long Beach in the fifth and sixth grades when I grew up. My mom, fifth grade was square dancing and sixth grade was ballroom dancing. My mom didn't want to send me at first when my Aunt Gloria invited me to join my cousin Randy's school group. "Oh, you'll quit that just like you did the piano," she said. "Oh no, Mom, this is different, you'll see." Never quite like the other children, this was the era of Vietnam, the Beatles, and the Beach Boys, and I, on the other hand, lived to cha-cha. A chubby little waltzing anachronism. And it was quite the social liability, too. If anybody at my school found out that I went, or what's more, that I loved it, I might as well just join Witness Protection Program and change schools then and there. We live in all kinds of closets, don't we? Mine was a split level. How did I feel? I was so thrilled to have the opportunity to revisit this very sweet, tender part of my youth. So Becky made a date for Shoshi and her to come over to the house, for Shoshi to teach me her basic dance steps and to give me the lowdown on just what was expected of me. "First off, Michael," she says, you got to wear a suit." "Oh God, I don't have a suit." Here it starts. Becky assured me that a jacket and tie would be fine and that Shoshi wasn't yet well versed on the finer distinctions of menswear. So she showed me her basic waltz and foxtrot steps, and I said, "Look, girl, I can teach you a routine. We can clear the floor." Not realizing this isn't exactly tops on an 11-year-old girl's agenda. So sadly, there would be no one-armed lifts at this particular cotillion. It's not about you, Michael. So the big day arrived. I raced home from work, so excited, got showered, changed into my jacket and tie, and I head over to the Wilshire Ebell. Within minutes of even parking my car, I was slapped awake into another reality that had layers of meaning that were not all sweetness and light for me. There I was, feeling so conspicuously less than in my light-colored khakis and my olive shirt and my chocolate blazer, and I see these men pull up in their Mercedes and their BMWs and emerge in beautifully tailored, sleek, expensive suits. Corporate and lawyer types, I'd assumed, rushing over from their offices in Century City or downtown, racing to meet their beautifully turned out wives and their lovely children to whom they'd given the best of everything. Successful, heterosexual, they had done life the right way. To put my feelings of insecurity, of being the outsider, in a kind of context and perspective, a few weeks earlier, I had found out in the most unceremonious way imaginable that I was to be laid off from my job as the palliative care chaplain at UCLA for lack of funds, a job that didn't pay enough to feed me as it was. And a week before that, the voters of California passed Proposition 8, largely through relentless television commercials that terrorized enough voters with the unthinkable possibility that the worst thing that could happen to your child would be that she finds out in school that I even existed. I was not feeling on top of the world. Insiders and outsiders. Here it was at the Wilshire Ebell Cotillion. I remembered the dress code handed down to me some 40 years earlier. Same thing, suit or jacket and tie. And I didn't have a suit then either. My mom went to Unimart, the forerunner to stores like Target, and she bought me this shiny polyester wide whale olive green corduroy sport jacket with plastic buttons made to look like real leather. I hated it, especially the buttons. I knew then that it wouldn't pass muster with some of those Mormon boys at Cotillion who, like those lawyers, they looked like they were born in their suits. But then the boys and girls start to arrive. Oh my God, the same prototypes to adolescence as 40 years ago. There were those who looked so at ease and confident and comfortable and eager to show off their new clothes and gossip and talk about their holiday plans. And there were those who looked like, oh God, they'd rather be going to their dog's funeral. But one thing that was in glorious contrast to 1964 was the sea of faces. The room looked like Los Angeles. There were Asian faces and Latino faces and African American faces. One of Thurgood Marshall's own great-grandnieces is there at a cotillion in Hancock Park in Los Angeles. Can you imagine that? And my friend Becky, an out, fiercely proud lesbian mom and her daughter, things can change, you know. But then the dancing began. Oh my God, what fun. I especially loved watching some of these boys who were a good 2 feet shorter than their partners. And they somehow had intuited that this sport of foxtrotting is all about who can take the biggest steps. And they're not quite sure why they're even playing music in the first place. But they're so damned earnest about it. And there I am dancing with Shoshana, and I'm feeling the oddest mix of pride and nostalgia, and I'm lost in reverie and wonder, and I'm feeling like the outsider, less than. And I look across the room and I spy the most beautiful little Latino boy dressed in a jacket two sizes too big, dancing with his proud mom, who at 5 feet tall is still a good head taller than her boy, dressed in what I'm sure is her finest, navy blue pants and a short sleeve white knit top, right next to the most glamorous cocktail dresses and party gowns, high heels and gloves. That was one multi-layered image for this little gay mama's boy in a shiny corduroy jacket, I have to say. Kind of exquisite, actually. Still, I was hopelessly short-sighted to not have foreseen what a minefield this cotillion could be, insiders and outsiders, particularly in my own micro-universe. This was the realm in which I felt the most at ease and confident and comfortable as a boy at 11. And now at 54, I'm somehow the outsider in my own universe. What gives? What's up with that? Can we be the outsider and the insider at the same time? And the whole intention of a cotillion is kind of a two-edged sword, isn't it? Teaching a kind of manners and grace and civility and confidence and poise. For what? Well, so that we can go through life with manners and grace and civility and confidence and poise, and that's a good thing, right? But is there buried in that also an agenda to maybe step up in class to greater power and access and privilege and influence, all the while solidifying this gender-specific, heteronormative universe? Becky shared with me her hesitation at even sending Shoshana in the first place. White gloves? White gloves to her had historically meant no Jews allowed. Not to mention all the gender-specific stuff and the heteronormative stuff. Isn't it ironic that this is the universe in which I felt the most at ease as a little gay child? Ballroom dancing with little girls in these prescribed roles. And just look at all the aspects of insider-outsider status evident at this sweet little cotillion. There's race, there's class, there's gender, there's sexual orientation, there's religion, there's a big old Christmas tree in the middle of the ballroom. But we close the party with everyone dancing the horror in a big circle. What a relief, huh? Ability. Even though too much dance ability for a little boy is not exactly a status builder, let me tell you. And the whole reason I was even invited in the first place, family structures. Hell, I just wanted to go to a party. This is so typical of what I do. Still, the whole experience got me thinking in a deeper way, spiritually speaking, about those feelings of being the insider and the outsider and where those feelings might intersect with faith. we look around the world, we can see dozens of religious systems that are built on the idea of us and them. We're inside, you're out. Defined by it, in fact. I'm so proud of our UU tradition, in which at least we proclaim the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. Do we always manifest that reality? Certainly not. I know that I don't. And in speaking spiritually, we can speak horizontally. That is, where do I see my connectedness to my place among things in the physical world? But we can also speak vertically. For many, that relationship is a vertical one, between myself and that which is beyond the physical, with a sense of fate, destiny, higher power, God, the divine, the transcendent. And in my own spiritual journey and in the lives of so many of the patients I've seen over the years, that vertical relationship can be fraught with just as many struggles of insider-outsider status as if it were the dance floor at the Wilshire E-Belt. In religious language, it might sound like, am I inside of God's grace, or somehow have I fallen from grace? Am I outside of God's grace? In the horizontal realm, in more secular language, the question might be, do I fit in? Do I belong? Am I enough? To me, it's the same issue and the same question, just different vocabulary. I have certainly seen over the years dozens of patients who are quite certain, quite convinced of their insider status, vertically speaking. During one of my units of internships at the hospital, I was assigned to liver transplants. I was making rounds one day and I went into Earl's room to introduce myself. Earl was, for this floor in particular, uncharacteristically chipper and bright-eyed. I introduced myself to the chaplain and he said, "Oh yes, please, chaplain, I happen to be a Baptist minister myself. I would simply welcome the opportunity to dialogue with fellow clergy." Oh, brother. Here we go, quiz time. So I sit down and I say, "So tell me, what's going on, Earl?" "Well, I couldn't be better, chaplain. I was so sick I almost died. And you know what? The Lord blessed me with a new liver and now I'm going to be just fine. Isn't it a miracle? You see, prayer works and the Lord blesses and keeps his own." Well, this just pissed me off. Earl and his theology. It's not very chaplain-like of me, I admit, but I just could not help myself. "Earl, I'm thrilled that you got this second chance of life. And yes, these liver transplants are indeed a miracle. But I do have to ask, what about the person who died and gave you that liver? Where do you suppose the blessing is in this for him or her?" His smile flattened out a bit, maybe forgetting that liver didn't get sent up from the pharmacy. "Well, I have no idea if that person was even saved or not." Wow. His insider status seems inextricably linked to the outsider status of his donor. Walt was a cancer patient, quintessential self-described self-made man. Grew up, rough and tumble beginnings, Irish Catholic, grew to amass millions in the defense and oil industry, not a bit shy about telling me what number of millions we were talking about, and no moral struggle at all with the defense and oil stuff. "Because, Michael, I simply used the gifts God gave me. That's all any of us has to do." In his view, it was as if his financial success were proof of his favor with God. He had done it the right way, by himself, by the world, and by God, insider all the way. It was the American capitalist success story as theology. And like Earl, he had a match between his theology, his belief system, and his circumstances. It was like an airtight case. One proved the other. There was no struggle, no paradox, no kind of mystery. It was open and shut. And it makes me wonder if we can still call it faith when there is that kind of match between one's circumstances and one's beliefs. Isn't faith more in the realm of reaching and aspiring to something that's always maybe a little bit outside of our reach, a little grander, a little loftier? I don't know. On the flip side of that coin, I have certainly been with dozens, if not hundreds, of folks who do not understand why God has not answered their prayers, why God has not rescued them from horrific suffering, torture, loss, and death, why they are the spiritual outsiders, as it were, particularly when a faith system that may be held them up their whole lives had told them something quite the opposite. Gary presented the most confounding conflation of all these ideas. It was my first unit of internship and one of my very first overnight on-call shifts at the hospital. A veritable grab bag of adventures every time that pager went off. So the pager goes off late at night, and I'm summoned to Gary's room on the 10th floor, hematology, oncology. Gary was going to have a stem cell transplant the next day. The nurse said he'd been very agitated and anxious, and she thought maybe a visit from me might help. Well, Gary was a fundamentalist Christian, and when he found out that I was neither a fundamentalist nor a Christian, he threw up his arms in kind of incredulous disgust, as if I might be contagious or something. What? You're not a Christian? I can't talk to you. I've got nothing to say to you. We have nothing in common. What's with this hospital hiring a chaplain who isn't a Christian? Heaven help me if he knew I were gay. But ever the earnest chaplain, I hung in there for close to an hour, naively and perhaps arrogantly, thinking I could tease apart his resistance to having a conversation with me. The guy was suffering. He was alone. He was so angry and anxious and scared, and I was it for somebody to talk to. Well, the thing is, Michael, I was told to have this transplant 6 months ago, and I told the doctor no. I said, the Lord's going to heal me, and when he does, I'm going to come back here and tell you I told you so. And if he doesn't heal me in 6 months, I'll come back and I'll have the transplant and you can tell me I told you so, but I'm going to stand on my faith. So here it is, 6 months later, and my transplant's tomorrow. Despite Gary's antipathy for me, I felt the most compassionate kind of affinity for him. Several times in my life, I have taken what would appear to be pretty reckless leaps of faith that have flown in the face of conventional wisdom and have not turned out the way I would have hoped. This journey into chaplaincy, not the least among them. My world's been rocked dozens of times. My faith has been shaken, destroyed, had to be rebuilt. I do know what it's like to put all of your eggs in one basket and to drop the basket. I thought perhaps on that page alone, maybe we could meet. So Gary, when the Lord didn't heal you, did you feel what? Abandoned or betrayed or angry or what was going on? Well, I've never felt any of those things. Why would I? If I had enough faith, the Lord would have healed me. And I didn't have enough faith, so he had this in mind for me, gesturing to the pumps and the tubes and the hoses. It doesn't bother me in the slightest. That's the Lord's argument. I'll find out when I get to heaven. I wasn't buying any of it. The guy was so angry and scared and anxious. But I had given all I knew how to give, and I thought maybe I'd open the door this much. So before I left, I said, Gary, before I go, would you maybe like to say a prayer or a blessing together? Again, the hand shot up in the air. I can't pray with you. I can pray for you, but I can't pray with you. How could I? You're not a Christian. We have nothing in common. And so I left. And I walked down this long, empty corridor back to the elevators feeling so dejected and angry and sad and wondering, what the hell was I thinking in tackling this chaplaincy thing anyway? Definitely the outsider. And there's Gary in his room having his own spiritual crisis of the vertical variety. The Lord chose not to heal him after all because he didn't have strong enough faith. All the while he's proclaiming somehow he's at peace with it. And he's alienated the one hand that was there in the darkness that could have maybe reconnected him, if only for a moment, horizontally speaking. There's something very tragic in that to me. As you use, it might be tempting to dismiss Gary and his experience and his circumstances somehow self-inflicted, as divisive, or maybe for some even as ridiculous. But before we do, I invite you to consider a time when your own faith was shaken. Maybe not the vertical variety, but certainly the horizontal variety. Our faith in our friendships, our families, our relationships, our faith in our work, our jobs. Our faith in our own capacity to make wise decisions. Our faith in our abilities. These days, our faith in maybe the notion that if we work hard, do the right thing, save our money, we'll be safe. We'll be okay. Of late, I've had to look at my own faith in the democratic process. One of our own foundational UU principles. As much as I believe in democracy, how did I and so many of us feel on November 5th of 2008 to get up and discover that Proposition 8 had passed, particularly in tandem with Obama being elected? What a soup of feelings that stirred up for me. I think for me the essential feeling was that of having been bullied by the masses, evoking this very old, familiar feeling of being bullied and taunted and harassed and beaten up on the playground, that same little sissy boy who now found himself dancing on the dance floor at the Wilshire Ebell. Has any of us not felt like the outsider when looking through that lens? And what, if anything, does being the outsider offer us? Jane Wagner, who created so much of Lily Tomlin's brilliant material years ago, she posited through the character Trudy the Bag Lady, after all, what is reality anyway? Nothing but a collective hunch. Being the outsider may be the only opportunity we have to step outside of the collective hunch that we call reality. As we move or are moved to that outsider position, it may be the only opportunity we ever have to really reevaluate and reassess everything that we have held to be true, to be dear, to be sacred. In the Native American tradition, there's the concept of the two-spirited being, the one who is seen as having both the male and female in the same body. We might call that person gay or transgender. In the Native American tradition, that person is seen as gifted with a vision that is not limited by the narrow perspective of one gender or another, and they're elevated. They become shamans and healers within the tribe. Well, all of that perspective and insight afforded the outsider is wonderful, isn't it? But it also hurts like hell, and it's lonely. And on the flip side, to feel like somehow I belong to my place in the world, to my family, to my job, or vertically speaking, that I'm held in the warm embrace of God's arms, well, that's as cozy and warm as a big comfy chair by the fire, isn't it? Who wouldn't want that all the time? From what I've observed, not too many of us are given the opportunity to sit by the fire forever. So I would ask myself, can I hold the tension between the two? Can I move with a little more grace between the warmth of the fire and the cold wind outside, even while life beckons me back inside, only to show me the door 2 minutes later? Can I even catch glimpses now and then of a larger reality in which this whole notion of insiders and outsiders is but an illusion? That the whole pursuit of the fire and the avoidance of the cold wind outside are both illusions of separation, that there really even exists anything but the oneness of life. My pursuit of that cozy, warm fire even be a kind of trap, luring me to a quest for affirmation and approval outside of myself. Can I discover a knowingness deep in my bones, as David White says in that beautiful poem, that I belong to that aloneness as I belong to my life? So much of this, insiders and outsiders, is a story we are making up about ourselves and each other's, moment to moment, as changeable as the wind, who's inside, who's outside. Because there I was, feeling so less than in my khakis in December, feeling so lost because I had been laid off from my job, beaten up by the voters of California, and actually thinking for a moment, if I just had a suit. And in one moment, I'm 11 and I'm 54 at the same time. And yet, a few days after the cotillion, I got this note from Shoshana. Dear Michael, thank you for dancing with me at the cotillion. I really loved your colorful tie. I hope that you enjoyed yourself. I also loved your brown and tan suit. See you soon. And so it is. Thank you. I would certainly agree that a lot of the spiritual pioneers, historically speaking, are outsiders, and I would argue that we do, all of us need that opportunity every now and then to step outside of the collective. But at the same time, I don't think we're ever going to truly experience communion unless we sometimes come back to that place of really feeling like I belong and that we're connected. So, again, my theme in my talk is that I think it's a dance between these two opposites all the time. Can I expand my consciousness to include the whole dance and not be so stuck in I'm an insider now? Like right now I have a job and I'm so thrilled to have a job. I've never been so grateful in a job in my life. It's only funded for a year though. And it scares me how happy the job makes me, because I know it can be taken away and may likely be taken away if there isn't any funding. So I don't want to be so dependent on that for my happiness. And I think, hell, screw it. Just enjoy the time you've got now and you've got a job. And I'm doing this ping pong dance in my head. So I do think we need both. This is it's a powerful question, because I face this as a chaplain all the time. I don't walk into a patient's room and say, hi, I'm your gay non-Christian chaplain. I'm just the chaplain. A lot of them will assume that I'm Christian. They'll also assume I'm heterosexual, so I've kind of got this closet that I'm carrying, and I have to hold this tension of when is it time for me to be authentic or not. What happens when I get close to a patient who's already told me they're from Bakersfield, they know Jesus died for their sins, and what about you, Michael? Are you married? How do I answer? My job is to relieve their suffering. If I come out and tell the truth to them, I've just pissed them off, and now I've just intensified their suffering. But do I deny myself and say, well, no, I'm single? You know, and the same thing with Christianity. I try to breathe into a place before I visit any patient that there's that spark that is common between us that is divine, however we want to call it. And I try to talk in a language that I can commit. I've had very devout Christians who, would you please say one of your beautiful prayers, Michael? And I never mention Jesus, and they don't know I'm not a Christian. But it's a way of coming close to somebody and affirming what's true for you that can also be true for them. If you believe, if you believe this is it and there is no spark within us, we're just biological mass, then that's a little trickier. But another task you can take is, if she's conversant, is to have her, which parts of the Bible mean something to you? Is there a passage you'd like me to read to you? You're not compromising yourself. Would you like me to read any of these Psalms or any of them that speak to you? Or just open a book and start reading. Or poetry is great because it's not so spiritual. Emily Dickinson has some of the most gorgeous poetry. David White, who wrote this poem, The House of Belonging. Just say, I brought some poems to read. Would you like that? Because if you go to the core of it, I don't even know that she really, really, really wants you to believe just like her and say this thing. What she wants to know is that she is not alone and that she matters and that you are there. Sometimes I see things so horrific it would be arrogant of me to open my mouth. You can't say anything in this situation. So, but I'm willing to be a witness. I'm willing to sit here. And you know what? I'm uncomfortable as hell and I don't know what to say, but I'm here, and take somebody's hand and hold it, smooth out their sheet, is all the prayer anybody really, really needs. And all of your angst about what to say, and I can't let her know I'm not a Christian, is energy spent that's keeping you from coming close to her at a very precious time. Thank you.